This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, episode 8, The Bugbears of Battle, Inciting Violence in Speculative Fiction. So really, we want to talk about what makes a good and realistic, ideally, fight scene in speculative fiction.
With particularly looking at how you can write realistic fight scenes, even if you are writing supernatural fight scenes.
Yes, so even if the fight includes magic, or it includes, I don't know, laser pistols, or
yeah.
A particular type of sci-fi.
Got an alien who has several more arms, I don't know, regenerative capabilities. The point is, we're going to look at battles and where writers have succeeded and where they have not quite succeeded. Jules, why don't you start?
Okay, well, I say we. It's not Madeline and I, we're not partners. My boyfriend and I have had a massive Buffy renaissance, and we've been watching them all the way through. And generally, Joss Whedon and the writers of the Buffy the Vampire series, it's always worth going back and watching them again. It's generally a good storyline. There are very few weak episodes, and the fight scenes tend to be very good and fairly realistic. I mean, you have to allow for the fact that you've got somebody who is super strong fighting things that aren't human a lot of the time. But the one thing she does that really, really annoys me is she very rarely blocks. And when she does block, it's a really big thing.
Yes. And that is an interesting thing. And obviously, in this case, it's more down to the choreography of the scenes. But looking at how she moves and how, she clearly has training.
Yeah.
She's absolutely not a weak opponent in the least. She's a good strategist. She has very good capabilities. And yet one of the first things that any martial artist will learn, or you learn in any form of fighting, is to block and to dodge, actually.
Yes, the best way not to get hit is not to be there.
Exactly. And both Jules and I are actually coming from this, from martial art backgrounds ourselves, if I'm correct. Jules, your style is, you do?
It's mostly Gojiru, but I've been doing martial arts for 20 years, and I've done 12 different martial arts, full stop, not counting different styles of karate.
So I've been doing Washinkai, which is based on Wataru and Shotokan, for about 10 years myself. And one thing that I often get asked is, what's the best move in karate? What's the most amazing move you can do? And I always I look them dead in the eye and I go, Taisubaki. And they go, oh, what's Taisubaki? And they get really excited. And I'm like, okay, do you want me to demonstrate Taisubaki? And they're like, yeah, show us. So I stand in front of them. I get into fighting stance. And then I move my back leg around.
Yep.
And then they're like, okay, but what's Taisubaki? And I'm like, Taisubaki is the ancient art of moving out of the way. And they're like, but how is that the best? And I'm like, you have... Taisubaki is the most important thing that you can possibly learn. Because as Jules so rightly put, the best way to avoid being hit is just not to be there when the punch gets to where your face should be. So to move out of the way and to continually move out of the way is just one of the best ways to win a fight, because you tire someone out. And I definitely won a fight where I just stayed just out of reach and they kicked and punched and did all these amazing moves. And I just sort of moved a little bit out of the way. And so they wasted all this energy and then easily won. But Buffy doesn't believe in dodging and she doesn't believe in blocking.
No, I mean, and obviously it is, as you say, it is a choreographer's choice, isn't it? I mean, it wouldn't be interesting if you didn't feel she was in jeopardy, if you didn't feel that she was getting punched, usually in the face, because people go, with a face punch, when, sometimes a blow to the body can actually be worse. Particularly if you get used to getting punched in the face, which is an odd thing to say, but you can actually get used to it to a certain level.
There is something else, though, which, and something we're going to be looking at a little bit more in depth, is that it isn't just fight scenes. It isn't just the techniques which need to be analysed. It's also the repercussions of how of what would happen, which is that if you punch somebody in the face enough times,
Yeah.
like, you can kill them,
It's
first
a
of all.
cumulative.
It is a cumulative. The amount of times I've seen fight scenes, I mean, Home Alone, they did an excellent analysis recently on all the injuries that the burglars would have gotten in Home Alone, and
Yeah.
how many times they should have died, how many bones should have been broken. So that's something else that we're going to be addressing. So Buffy is obviously very strong in a lot of people's minds, because I think that Buffy was a bit of a, well, it was a pop culture thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, you wouldn't have had a lot of the. I hate the expression strong female character because, as far as I'm concerned, you have a female character. You don't say strong male character because
Yes.
that suggests somebody in an Edwardian sort of circus who happens to have a pet leopard and wears a striped bathing costume and wields a mallet. So why would you say strong female character? It's.
Unless you are also describing a woman who happens to have a pet leopard.
Yeah.
And
It's like you're suggesting that all other female characters are weak. So ignoring that bugbear, because that's really nothing to do with what we're talking
that's
about.
another episode.
That's another episode entirely. The character and the way it was done opened the doors for the fact that men would watch this, and not just because they got something a little bit kinky out of watching a girl fight, but because it was interesting in its own right.
And you know, it paved the way for a lot of television, and it paved the way for how fight scenes were done. Because the one thing with Buffy is that the fight scenes were very gritty. So as you say, they went for the face. You know, they went for the cheap shots as well. It wasn't all epic sort of shing shing. You know, sorry, that's the sound swords make apparently.
Yes. That's an
That's
issue.
something else we'll go into, realistic sound effects.
So there's one that sticks in my mind is obviously Angel turns evil. If you haven't seen Buffy and I'm spoilifying you, I'm sorry, but where have you been? I mean, come on. Angel turns evil and she does win an initial fight with him and then she can't bring herself to do the killing move. So she does a jumping front kick into his bollocks. Which he has coming by that point. And naturally, being still male, even though a vampire, he does go down from that, which you'd expect. That was an ordinary human, you'd expect a ruptured testicle, to be fair, but
Well, how do you know that he didn't rupture something?
he might well have done, and then being a vampire, he just healed. Good point. But yeah, it's things like that. As you say, it will go for the cheap shots, the nasty stuff, the stuff that actually really works.
I'm going to go on to, from Buffy, we're going to go on to another superhero. And the second series has just recently come out on Netflix, and that is Matthew Murdock, Daredevil. For anyone who hasn't had the privilege of watching Daredevil yet, I very much recommend it. I'm on the second series at the moment. I'm really enjoying it. And a little bit of context for those people who don't know the character of Daredevil. He is a blind lawyer by day and a blind vigilante by night. But even though he can't physically see, he has heightened senses due to something, I don't know, radioactive slop. I can't remember the exact details of what happened, but he's got these powers which give him very heightened senses. However, he fights in a very realistic way. He's an extremely skilled fighter, and he fights in a very realistic way. And something I really, really like about Daredevil is the way they do the fight scene. In particular, they have these fight scenes which are all done in one take, and I call them corridor fight scenes because they tend to take place in corridors. And in the most recent one, they upgraded from the corridor fight scene and had Daredevil fighting his way the whole way down a spiraling set of stairway, like several floors, and it's just the camera just continues to follow him as all these people come from all angles, and the camera never sort of really comes off of him, and it's all done in one take. And I really, really, as a martial artist, as a viewer, I really enjoy Daredevil because it's incredibly gritty, it's incredibly realistic, and you get a real sense of the damage done by each blow. It's very realistic. Of course, it's a little bit fanciful because you know, he's got this ability, which means that he can tell when someone's about to attack him from behind. So some of the contextual stuff is a little bit sort of unbelievable. But the fight itself, the techniques are very realistic, and the strength and things like that. For instance, you kick someone, they don't fly 30 meters, they probably just fall over. So a very good understanding of strength and the human capacity.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's something almost, but not quite, a bit like ninjutsu in there, in the sense of you get in very close, you do something very nasty, and you get out again.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they add some of the more long distance techniques as well.
Yeah.
But I agree. It's clearly someone with a knowledge of human anatomy
mm-hmm.
involved in the choreography.
And it's very well put together. And I think the reason as well why it's so good is because Murdoch's powers have nothing to do with his actual fighting ability. Murdoch's powers have a lot to do with his sensory, you know, he's able to sense what's coming from where, but his ability is entirely human, and you can see the level of skill. But unlike a lot of other sort of martial arts films and stuff like that, where you see regular people performing techniques which would not realistically happen, you can completely believe in everything that Daredevil is doing. You can believe in all of the moves, and they still look awesome, because it's a very difficult line between making something realistic and making it enjoyable. And I think that they've found the balance.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. From a martial arts and just a general, possibly might have had a couple of fights in my life point of view.
Not admitting anything.
Without admitting anything, the stuff that works generally doesn't look pretty. Unless you're part of a Chinese opera, so
and this is true, the real damage tends to be done in scuffles, and it tends to be cheap headshots, it tends to be cheap nut shots,
knees, elbows, people breaking fingers and
biting as well. That's a biting. Real
eye gouging, fish hooking, all the nasty stuff that
going for the eyes and other orifices. Except don't go for the mouth, because there are teeth there. It's just pro tip for anyone. If you're punching someone, don't punch them in the mouth. It'll hurt you probably more than it'll hurt them, unless you've been trained specifically how to use your fist properly.
In fact,
you will regret it.
If you haven't been trained how to use your fist properly, use a really hard slap instead of your fist, because you're more likely to hurt your own hand. Unless, of course, you know what you're doing, in which case, who am I to tell you?
You go right ahead.
Obviously, we're talking from a self-defense perspective.
Yes. Also, pro tip, the headbang. This is something that's a real bugbear that I see, is that people sort of grab. They do that. What's the official word for it?
I think it's a headbutt, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a headbutt. That's it. The headbutt. And you see it all the time in movies, and they use it quite often for comedy effect. And it's literally people just grab hold of another person's face and they smack their face against theirs. No. That you do that when you're kissing somebody, but do not just smack your face against somebody else's. It'll hurt a great deal, because if you think about it, you're trying to hurt them by hitting them in exactly the same place that you are then hitting yourself. This does not make logical sense. Proper way to headbutt somebody, again, this is an entirely self-defense, is to hit them in the nose with your forehead.
So you use the cranium, which is the hardest part of your skull, to hit all the crunchy, smooshy bits at the front of their face.
Crunchy, smooshy is the official terminology. Coming from someone with a medical...
Okay, the cartilaginous area.
Jules, didn't you work for the hospital at some point?
Oh yeah, I worked for the NHS for years.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about did you ever come across people who'd fought because they'd been trying to imitate something from TV and it just didn't work out?
Yes, those were interesting bruises and fractures.
Okay. The moral of the story is don't believe most fight scenes on TV. Do not attempt it. But if you are going to attempt it, follow Daredevil's example. Except don't follow Daredevil's example, because he gets shot a lot and it's fairly uncomfortable for him. So anyway, so from Daredevil, I feel that that leads us very smoothly on to discussing, again, in sort of more particular detail, fights that involve magical powers or alien advantages. And our counterpart of Matthew Murdock with Daredevil at the moment is Jessica Jones.
Yeah, and Jessica Jones is part of the whole Marvel universe as well. It wasn't a character I'd really come across until they made the TV series.
No,
and she is a really great character, but she's super powered. She's super strong. At no point has she actually bothered to learn how to fight.
No.
It really bugs me.
Looking at Jessica Jones on the whole, as an entirety, as a show, I really liked Jessica Jones for several of reasons. And this is just a quick review of Jessica Jones. I liked Daredevil because it feels very much like an action story, but with a very real, a very gritty, a very real kind of bit below it. The characters are incredibly three-dimensional. And another thing I liked about Daredevil is at one point, the character Matthew Murdock in the first series cries when he thinks that he's going to lose the friendship of somebody he really cares about. And normally, typically, male superheroes only cry under extreme duress. So if, you know, they've been utterly defeated or somebody they love has died, and they're not, that they've got to be quite manly men, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Matthew Murdock cries because he thinks he's really upset his friend, and he thinks he's going to lose his friend. And that, and contextually with the situation, it made total sense, and it didn't make him any less. He seemed like a very real person, the kind of person that you could actually genuinely meet. Now, Jessica Jones was quite a challenge because obviously female superheroes are still a little bit of a new thing as far as when it comes to, you know, media. We don't often get films or TV series especially that follow female superheroes. You know, they can be a part of a larger other film. You know, we've got Black Widow in the MCU, but to have a series entirely based, you know, it's the same with Supergirl, and we'll go on to Supergirl a little bit later. But Jessica Jones is written basically as a kind of noir detective story. And very interestingly, they basically assigned all of the traditionally male roles in the story and all of the traditionally female roles to the opposite gender. So actually, Jessica Jones is almost entirely a female cast. The gritty PI who has an alcohol problem and is smart and sort of a little bit sort of bad-tempered, that's Jessica. She's obviously a woman. The smart lawyer who's having an affair is a woman. It's all actually, it's mostly women. It's a very strong female cast. And someone made a point that said, I really don't like Jessica Jones because I watch it, and all of the male characters are either supporting roles or they're eye candy.
And then they
stopped and went, oh, this is what it feels like to be a woman all the time. It's just, they're like, yeah. So Jessica Jones has got a very different feel to Daredevil because it's definitely a noir, it's an LA noir kind of thing. And so, no, she's not a fighter. She's never learnt to fight because that's not her job. She's a PI. She does the sneaky sneak, not the punchy punch. She's not necessarily a vigilante. She sort of tries to become a vigilante at one point, but as you so rightly point out, Jules, she doesn't have any training, which I kind of approved of, because they decided, where would she have gotten training? She's super strengthed. Where would she have been able to learn how to fight without somebody noticing?
For one thing, if she's that super powered strength-wise, she would have had to have learned to control it to some extent. Otherwise, every time she picked up a cup of coffee, she'd have shattered it. So,
yeah, this is true. But at the same time,
to rein it in.
At the same time, you have to remember that, given her character, she was actually she wasn't that young when she developed her powers. You know, she was in her late teens when she developed her powers, and she's not that much older now. And she's also not a very patient, she's patient in her sort of work, but I don't think she had the capacity to sort of go to a gym and train herself up like that.
It's more that she has an authority problem, I think. And then you add in the PTSD that comes along later, then that's a real recipe for her not acquiring extra skills, I think.
Basically, yeah. And she doesn't have any training, which actually really works. I'm not a big Superman fan because it's just there, like, why should I care about someone who could literally be blasted into the sun and survive? You know, why should I care about this person? By making Jessica super strength and giving her this sort of, she can't really fly, she can fly, but she's not really learned how to do it. And again, that she hasn't even bothered to learn how to fly properly, so why would she even bother trying to learn how to fight? By giving her this super strength but not giving her any training, it allowed the stakes to sort of remain relatively realistic whilst still making her quite awesome, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so a more identifiable character. And she is a mess psychologically.
She is a mess, yeah. And it also goes to show that her super strength wasn't everything. She wasn't innately good at fighting just because she had super strength. I think that's a joke actually in Buffy, going back to Buffy, yeah, about the vampires who just pop out of the ground able to
suddenly,
martial arts.
You know, you're an ordinary person, you get bitten, you die, you come back from the dead, and suddenly it's like the Matrix and someone's downloaded all these martial arts programs.
Which, so again, I kind of liked. So that created for me a realistic fight scene in a speculative fiction context without having to remove any of the magic, without having to remove any of the, you know, the speculative aspect. Now, going on from that, I did mention Supergirl, and should we talk about Supergirl, or should we talk books for a little bit?
Let's look at some books. But I do like Supergirl. I haven't finished watching it, in fairness, but it's much lighter
than Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
I do like Supergirl. I approve of it. I think that it's nice that we now have a choice. Girls don't have to go, well, the only female-led superhero thing I can watch is about a woman who was essentially raped and abused. You know, they can also watch Supergirl. It's nice that we have a choice about sort of different tones and the kind of content that you want to watch. Proof of that. And Supergirl, obviously what they do is that the way they make her fight seems realistic is obviously she's fighting, she tends to be fighting superpowered villains, but it's a lot to do about her inexperience. So again, we have a Jessica Jones aspect, which is that they talk about she may have all these powers, but she's inexperienced, and in this case, skill outmatches power.
Yeah, which I think is actually reasonable to say, because it doesn't matter how strong somebody is, there is a way of throwing them, using mm-hmm. their own strength against them. So,
and it all comes down to dodging. It doesn't matter how strong someone is, if they can't land a hit, you can use their strength against them. So yeah, I guess that's one of the main ways that they are able to make Supergirl approachable as a watcher. Now, going on to some books, I believe that you had a couple, Jules, that you wanted to discuss.
One sort of segues quite nicely onto another. So I've mentioned Tamara Pierce before, and she mm-hmm. wrote her initial trilogy, quartet even, was The Song of the Lioness. And it's sort of set in medieval-esque fantasy realm. And it's a girl who wants to be a knight, but it's not an option for her. But it was quite groundbreaking at the time it was written, because there wasn't a lot of that then mm-hmm. at all. And she still has vulnerabilities, she's flawed, she has a terrible temper and a very short fuse, and it gets her into a lot of trouble. She gets where she wants to be via really, really hard training. It's not a case of her being this sort of big, strong character. She's quite weak, she's stocky rather than muscular, she's short, and she does manage to pass herself off as a boy. And a lot of her characters are like that, but they're competent because they've worked at it. They're not competent because it's been handed to them on a platter. So I really like that. But then if you look at some of the others, Joe Abercrombie writes very good fight scenes as well. So The Blade Itself, Last Argument of Kings, the things set in that world. His characters tend to be quite twisted because really nasty stuff has happened to them.
Now, here's
That's all right. I was just going to go on and say, and then if you go to The Broken Empire trilogy, there's now two trilogies effectively by Mark Lawrence. What he does is he does write good individual fight scenes, but he writes good overall fight scenes showing, you know, the eagle eye view of a battle. And so you go from being right in the thick of it to looking down at it, and he doesn't glorify any of it. It's a mess. It's realistic, it's believable and horrible and gritty and quite compelling at the same time.
So here's a question. Obviously, fight scenes in books and fight scenes on TV are very different. They're presented in very different ways now. In films, we can see them. But writing a fight scene is quite difficult. And there is an argument about how much you go into detail about the technique and how much you go into about sort of the resounding emotions. Now, I have a story, which is that when I was workshopping, for those people who don't know, workshopping is when, in this case for a writer, is when a group of writers all come together and we read out each other's work and we look through their work as a whole, as a collective, to help them improve it. So while I was workshopping with a group of people, one guy had written this fight scene, and at one point he went into explicit detail about how to break a man's neck and about his character breaking this other guy's neck. And I'm sitting there listening to it, and first of all, he was wrong. That's the first thing I thought. Well, it's
That's not
probably
gonna
going to be
work.
really uncomfortable. But I said, does this guy have super strength? And I said, the only way that would work would be if he was just ripping his head off. This guy, the character didn't have super strength. He was just breaking the guy's neck. I said, look, first of all, that's not how you do it. And so this boy said, well, can you tell me how to do it? And I said, no. I'm not actually allowed to tell you how to break somebody's neck, oddly enough, but and I wouldn't have done it anyway. I said the main objection I had was, first of all, you went into all of this detail about something that you didn't really know about, which meant that anyone with any sort of martial arts training would have gone, well, I don't really, this is totally unbelievable. They wouldn't have been able to invest in the story because it was incorrect. But second of all, you completely lost the shock value, because on the one side he went he literally, it was literally sort of two lines describing this, and I said you should just say he snapped his neck, like that simple. He snapped his neck, four words, because what you're trying to portray when you talk about that is a certain shock value. You're trying to give a certain, there's a speed to it. When you break someone's neck, it's not a slow process. It has to be very quick, usually. So you want that to be reflected in the writing. It's a very instantaneous part. Now, if you want an instantaneous action, now, if you wanted to build that up a little bit more, you could go into the emotional side of it. But going into detail about the exact movement of your hands in that sense, even if he'd written it correctly, would have been, it was detrimental to the story. So in these fight scenes that you've read, Jules, how have you found the balance between technique and emotion?
Okay, one part that struck me particularly, I think it was in King of Thorns by Mark Lawrence. Basically, the character starts off in a really bad position at the very beginning. And I don't mean a bad position in a fight. I mean, it's his wedding day, and by the way, there's a war literally about to happen. I mean, literally 5 minutes away about from about to happen. And you're wondering how on earth he's going to get out of it. And the way it's, but he has to go through the with marriage, otherwise the troops, his backup is not going to arrive. When I say he has to go through with the marriage, I mean literally all of it, as in prove it's consummated, and then we'll give you the backup troops. But what struck me about that was, as blackly comedic as it was, and that's where you start, but that's not, and that's where you end the story, but the rest of it is all in between, and it involves being told in a lot of flashback, and I think that book deserved the award that it got in the end for the way it went about it. But the one that struck me most was they were having this particular war, and he was chancing a lot, the character was chancing a lot on the fact that he knew the terrain and the invaders did not, even though they had a much larger, much better army, much better equipped, much better trained, and they'd set up a trap for them. The bit that struck me was there was one part where they're charging up the mountain afterwards, and he stabs someone, he literally stabs back behind himself to get someone off him, and he feels the blade slide in to the man's lower gut. Now, a gut wound like that is basically a death sentence unless you happen to have a very skilled team of surgeons on standby straight away. And it generally means that that person can't move on. So you've got somebody lying there, and that sort of horrible wound tends to make people cry out and pull at people coming past them, begging for help. And this is the point where the main character coldly reflects that actually, in a war, in a battle like that, your injured man is far more used to you than a dead man. You don't want to just kill them off. You want to mortally injure enough of them that they're hampering the others to buy you time. And it was that particular one. It was like, okay, that's horrible, but that's actually really accurate.
Yeah, and that's also very cleanly done, because sorry, cleanly done, as in it's obviously it shows a good level of understanding of the skill, but there's definitely an emotional and strategic aspect to that description, to the way that it goes in. It reminds me the Lord of the Rings books. We compare them with the movies. The movies are pretty much 70% battle, I feel. And I feel that the books are more along the lines of about 30% battle.
I think that's probably fair, yeah.
There's significantly more battle in the films, and it's very epic, whereas in the books there's a lot of talking, there's a lot of sort of politics and history and random people bursting into song as well, because
That's what
elves and dwarves, it's their thing. And I remember, and obviously it's very interesting because you've got Tolkien himself, and Tolkien was living through that. It was World War, remind me, Jules.
Oh, World War One, sorry.
It was World War One. I'm not very good with dates.
Yeah, he and three friends were obviously conscripted and they went off to fight, and I think only two of them came back. I mean, C.S. Lewis fought as well. And they both basically worked it out in their own way. For those who don't know, Tolkien and Lewis were part of the Inklings, who used to meet at the what they called the Baby and Bird, the Eagle and Child in Oxford, years later, as part of a writing group because they both taught at Oxford. Lord of the Rings, in a way, was partly Tolkien's love of epics like the Poetic Edda and Beowulf, and his frustration that we didn't have anything really like that ourselves. But it was also his way of really working out everything that had happened in World War One, having fought in the trenches.
And there's a particular scene in the books that you kind of see in the film, except that the way they do it in the books, you can suddenly see Tolkien in it, and it's Merry and Pippin obviously get separated, and then the third one they get rejoined again, and I think it's Pippin goes looking for Merry, who was out on the who hasn't been found on the battlefield. And in the films, Pippin finds Merry, and Merry's lying there, and Pippin says, "I'm going to take care of you," and it's quite nice like that. But in the book, something interesting happens. In the books, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jules, because it was a little while ago that I read it, but Pippin finds Merry just wandering around in total shell shock, and Merry is convinced that he's dead. And Pippin grabs him and sort of drags him off, and it's almost comedic. But there's a very that there's no sort of fussiness about it. Pippin just needs to get Merry in and safe and warm, and Merry's in a total state, but he's not crying, he's not weeping, he's just totally out of it. And I feel that on the one side we lost something in the film, which it was much more emotional sort of exchange, but the book gave us something. It gave us a real idea about what life was like in the trenches, what life was like during World War One, especially, in the battle. And it was this, there was no real time for anything other than pure necessity. And this, the shell shock that Merry goes through has just stayed with me always. And I think it is one of the truest reflections of battle that we ever see. And the fact that even though there's this great war going on throughout two of the books, that we only we the battles are incredibly short, I think is actually a real reflection of what life was like and what life is really like when you are at war, which is that actually a majority of the time is spent building up to battles and the politics and the fear and the emotional side of things like that, but the fights themselves end very quickly. It's all because you've got the adrenaline, you've got a lot of things happening. It actually ends quite fast.
I mean, even if you have a battle that, for example, if you take the Battle of Hastings, which was allegedly between 12 and 15 hours long, the entire battle, even that's comparatively short when you think about they'd spent, well, William's troops in Normandy ended up getting beached for months on end because they couldn't cross the channel because the weather was too bad, and then Harold had just force marched everybody down from Stanford because he'd had to fight a battle there. There's boredom, there's waiting, there's the horrible sense of having to be alert constantly, and the fact that food might be running out and there might be disease running right through
There's
the
a lot
camp.
of dysentery. And my favorite thing about it is that often when battles went on too long, they would take a lunch break. They took a lunch break in the Battle of Hastings. They get
Well,
us.
understandably, yeah.
They said, all right, hold on. And they just stopped fighting for a little bit. And I was learning about the Battle of Hastings when I was a kid, and I just always had this very amusing image, which is that you just have someone just going, ask them if they've got any butter. We've run out on this side. Just people running between, just like, have you got anything? And just swapping stuff. And then they kind of all sort of packed their picnics away, and they stood up and they kind of looked at each other like, everybody ready? All right, and start. And they just recommenced. But it was an honour thing, which is that they both agreed, right, we're going to stop. And they kind of ate, eyeing each other a little bit, sort of, as they ate. And then they only started again when everyone was ready to start. And it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre.
It is bizarre, but think about the whole thing. Literally, if you step outside it, it's ridiculous.
The
whole concept of war almost is ridiculous.
Like, a couple of very important people are going to send thousands of people they deem less important to die for an ideal or for, like... When you think about the real, it's a giant realistic chess game is what's happening.
Yeah.
And I think that that was definitely reflected in The Lord of the Rings, and it was reflected more in the books. The genuine realities of battle is more reflected in the books than it is in the films, even though in the books we don't get much detail about the fights themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you put yourself in, is it Merry or Pippin's place, wandering around shell-shocked?
It's Merry.
Yeah, Merry. Well, if you put yourself in Merry's place, and just, it's like a natural disaster, isn't it? Where you've had a tornado and it's come along and it's taken this house and that house, but it hasn't taken yours. And in this case, it's a case of this person's dead and that person's dead. And for some reason, you're still standing upright, but you may as well be sort of at the gates of hell at that point. So maybe you are actually already dead and you don't know it.
And you need to remember that Merry and Pippin were very much a reflection of people who were signing up for the adventure of it. You've got Frodo, who's kind of obligated to do it. But Merry and Pippin were the young, fresh-faced boys who kind of just decided to tag along. And they're from the Shire, you know, they're very jovial people. Even in the books, they're very jovial, and they're very close, they're cousins, and they're best friends. And I think Merry's been taking care of Pippin all his life. And they were representative of these boys who signed up because it was the, you know, you sign up.
Yeah, some of them as young as 14, having learned about their age.
Yeah, because they thought that it was the place to be. And then the reality sets in, and you've just got Merry just wandering there, and Pippin knowing that he can't fuss over Merry, he just needs to get him in safe. And he keeps, it just sticks with me. And Merry keeps saying, am I dead? And Merry, I think Merry's even insisting he needs to be buried or something like that. Or, yeah. You know, he needs to be taken to the, and Pippin's there like, no, you're not dead, let's get you. And I wonder whether something like that, Tolkien didn't actually see something like that, whether this interaction, the interactions that he writes about, which kind of seem, when you read them, they're a little bit like, oh, this isn't very emotional. But deeper, underneath all of that, there is so much turmoil. There is probably so much turmoil inside of him. As you say, he was trying to come to terms with what he'd seen and what he'd been through in a time where it wasn't considered correct for men to express themselves in that way. It wasn't considered correct for men to express to express themselves and to say that they were afraid, and thus the whole stigma when shell shock really started, you know, to become an issue when people came back, and people with PTSD who couldn't go anywhere because it was so stigmatized, because people didn't want to understand it. People didn't want to look at it.
It's enough of a stigma still nowadays. There still probably isn't enough support. But if you look at the First World War, the real absolute shame of it was the fact that so few of the young men and the older men came back. And unless they had jobs to return to, if they'd been seriously injured, they ended up begging, and they were figures of scorn and ridicule. People didn't want to be reminded of the war, so they tended to turn away from them. There wasn't help given to them.
Mm.
Utterly disgusting, really.
But yeah,
that scene from Lord of the Rings, as you said, just goes to show that you can write a really good fight scene without any fights in it at all.
Yeah, exactly. And it was very, very provocative. It was very much show, not tell, I guess.
Yeah, so it's a case of how much do you have on screen, and really the only bits you need on screen are the bits that are absolutely relevant.
Yeah, but I think it would be very difficult to tra it was difficult to translate that part of the book into the film. And I really approve of the films. I in some ways I actually feel that the films are better than the books. I know people are not
I
going to be
think they told a straighter and very, very dark story. So yeah, in a lot of ways, I like the films more than the book for
And
what.
I also feel that the films gave us more of the characters.
Yeah.
The books, the characters were a little bit, you didn't get that much from them, really, if that makes sense.
No, I mean
There
it.
was a definite sense that they were, he wrote it like it was an epic, and they don't tend to actually have characters in the epics, to be honest.
No, you are dissociated from them, aren't you? Because you're hearing a grand tale that happened long ago and it was
It's more about the
same
plot than the
thing.
characters, yeah.
Yeah.
So that goes to show.
Right. A different bugbear, and moving on from war. Complete disregard for the laws of physics during a fight.
Yeah, let's talk about the laws of physics and also the laws of we'll then go on to the laws of medicine,
Yeah.
biology,
Anatomy.
and yeah, the laws of anatomy. So the laws of physics when you are fighting, well, according to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, if you get good enough at Kung Fu, you can fly, which is improbable, highly improbable.
It is improbable. It made for a visually spectacular kung fu martial arts fairy tale.
And yeah, we are talking. It is, and that's why we can say that we decided that it's definitely speculative fiction, because if the moment you have people flying, that's no longer
Well,
yes.
unless there's something someone out there wants to tell us that we clearly don't
If
know.
someone out there wants to correct us, please,
We've
I
had a moment.
urge you to get in contact.
Humankind has had a moment of punctuated equilibrium, and we've moved forward, and we can actually fly, and we don't know about it yet. So.
Tell us very soon, because I would love
No.
to to get in on that. But it isn't just flight. I think that, and this goes again into sort of fighting realistically. In order to make things visually interesting, films, and we can and we owe it a great deal to cinema. It's not much to do with books. The books now reflect the visual components that we expect. A lot of fights are totally unrealistic because of the impact that certain strikes will have. And as I said before, with Daredevil, you've got people kicking others and sending them flying backwards, like through dry walls and stuff like that, and people hitting others with bottles and stuff like that. And this is
Yeah.
again going into sort of anatomy. This is just a bit of a forewarning for anyone who's interested. Do not hit someone else with a bottle. Please, please don't, because the thing is, you see people get hit with bottles all the time. And people forget the obvious thing, which is that if you get hit with a bottle, you'll get cut. Okay, if it's an empty bottle, you will at least give them severe lacerations in the head, which can kill a person because you bleed a lot around the head. And if it's a full bottle, that has got enough force, even if you don't swing it very hard, to kill somebody.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty severe blunt force trauma right there.
Yeah, so don't do that, because they do it all the time in films, and subsequently they do it all the time with books, is that they bottle people. And I remember, I don't know if you've ever seen In Bruges,
Yes.
that's that great bit where he says what the appropriate form of response is if someone attacks you with a bottle, and at one point a woman grabs the bottle and he goes, bottle! And so he's allowed to sort of smack her because she's grabbed a bottle and she's trying to bottle him. And it's meant to be a joke, because you're meant to be like, well, actually, a bottle isn't that bad. But no, a bottle is that bad. If someone comes at you with a bottle, flee, because either they're stupid or they mean to kill you. So that's one thing that is very frequent in films, is you get the bottle to the head.
It's flying kicks from a standing start.
Yeah, flying
And
kicks from a standing start is another one.
I am going to quote Buffy on this and say, yeah, what is powering that raw enthusiasm? because I'm sorry, you need the build up of the potential energy transferred into kinetic energy through movement in order to power a flying kick, if you choose to do a flying kick.
We do not recommend you try doing a flying kick.
But should you be doing one, you cannot do one from a standing start. That just doesn't work.
Again, if you are able to do a flying kick from a standing start, please get in contact with us and teach us your ways. Other sort of slightly things that make you question a little bit the sort of the reality of physics, the laws of physics, are now it is possible to run up walls and things like that.
Yeah.
It is possible, but as you know, people who do parkour show us all the time with their videos. I love parkour videos because
They're
it's like
great.
they're fantastic. But again, it's about momentum. About
Yeah.
momentum. It's about speed. They do what the normally when you see parkour videos, you see them on the go. Now they've been running for a while. They've built up the forward momentum. They're going from there. They're highly trained. They've got muscles in the right places, and they know how to do certain stuff. But very often you see people sort of run up walls in films without any kind of momentum, really, and it worries me because either they're Spider-Man or maybe they're disobeying the laws of physics.
Yeah. I mean, realistically, in an actual fight, you're very unlikely to do any sort of spinning kick because it means turning your back, and very few people are good enough to pull off one that quickly
Yeah.
so that it's effective. You're not going to do that. You're going to do what is most effective, which means you're going to take out somebody's knee by kicking it, or you're going to get them in the groin, you're going to get them fairly low down in the tandem or the solar plexus, and then you're going to get the head when it comes down.
Now,
It's again with head kicking, you wouldn't necessarily go straight in with a head kick because,
it's
why do that and put in all that effort when you can just knee them in the face as they come down?
as they come down. Also, another thing is that you are very unlikely to go for a high kick because you are exposing your arteries in your thighs, which you don't want to be doing. You're also exposing your groin. Now, it doesn't matter if you're a woman or a man, it really hurts to be punched in the groin. So that's a bit of a no-go, is these flying, amazing, spectacular moves tend to actually require more energy. If you could do something with three punches, which you could do with a huge flying kick, which is the equivalent of three punches, you're going to go for the three punches every time because it's quicker, it's cleaner, it's less risky. Now, talking about the laws of anatomy, this is a real bugbear of mine. And again, we've talked about this, but it isn't just headshots. Now, you mentioned a good old punch to the solar plexus. People underestimate what a good old punch to the solar plexus can do.
Once you've had a few of those.
You start to appreciate more what a good old punch to the solar plexus can. Try this at home, kid. Do not try this at home,
Do not
kids.
try this at home. If it's done correctly, it will actually temporarily make your lungs fold in on themselves and expel all the breath from your body.
It and even if you're highly trained, in order to function as a martial artist, you do sort of need to breathe.
Yeah.
A little bit.
There is a and also a sort of nebula ball of nerves right behind the solar plexus as well. If someone knows what they're doing and they hit up into what they call the xiphoid process, there's a really nasty little triangular piece of cartilaginous bone there which you can then send splintering into somebody's internal organs. I feel safe saying this because you'd have to really, really know what you're doing to be
Yeah,
able to get that to work.
you would. There's also something called the brachial nerve.
Yeah.
The brachial nerve is, if any of you have ever hit your elbow, the funny bone, and it sends the weird feeling the whole way through, that's the brachial nerve. The brachial nerve can also be accessed from the other side of the joint and along the arm. Hit the brachial nerve properly, and you can give someone a dead arm. That's what happens when you give someone a dead arm. And I have myself have been in sort of fights whilst training, and it's very difficult to hit the brachial nerve just on the cuff. That's not actually that easy, but someone did it by accident and my arm just flopped the
It's like
entire
you're looking at your hand and you can't actually make your fingers
you
close.
can't I still had to continue fighting, but I just had this arm flapping beside me as much. I lost that fight, but it took a good long while to heal. Now, if you consider how long it took for the brachial nerve to recover, for me to recover from being struck in the brachial nerve, if you get struck in the arm hard enough, you're not going to be able to punch with that arm.
No.
You're not going to be able to fight back with that arm. Also, a few good punches to the ribs are normally enough to disable even the burliest of men,
To
you
be,
know.
especially if you've got the floating ribs.
Especially if you've got the floating ribs, yeah. Broken ribs are nothing to laugh about, and we sort of go, we do go, ah, broken ribs, whatever.
Yeah.
But
They really hurt. In fact, bruised ribs really, really hurt.
bruised ribs. I have almost perpetually bruised ribs, and they are incredibly painful. And yet, in so many fight scenes, broken ribs tend to be the go-to thing. And I quite often break my character's ribs because it's the easiest way to it's the easiest way to break a bone and to give serious injury without having to risk a limb. So if you still need them to be able to run, to be able to move their arms, you can do that. However, do not underestimate the broken rib, because one false fall with a broken rib,
You've got punctured lung.
you've got a punctured lung. And it is still a bone which is broken. So people underestimate, because obviously, and I think another reason people underestimate is if you can't see the injury, people don't tend to sort of think it's that bad, unless, you know, so if you've got a sling, then people go, oh, they're wearing a sling. But you can't really sling your ribs, oddly enough.
Yeah.
And because of that, people don't really think of it in the same way, just as people don't really think of the implications of bruising the bone, fractured fingers.
So what we're driving at here is if you're writing a fight scene, then okay, less is always more, but also think about the consequences of the injuries, because there is nothing more annoying than reading a fight scene or watching a fight scene and someone gets a really nasty blow and gets seriously injured and 5 minutes later they're fine and it's clearly been forgotten about.
Now, a good way to combat this is if you happen to have a character who can heal very, very quickly. For instance, Matthew Murdock, Daredevil, fight scene's very realistic. He does get into a lot of stuff, but he's able to continue functioning because he can actually heal relatively quickly. I do the same with my character, Rufus Merle. He heals very quickly, and that means that I can break his ribs willy-nilly, just for the fun of
He must just love you.
it. But you have to remember, more most importantly, is that this is another bugbear, which is that you've injured a character in a fight in order to give it sort of more thing in a fight, and then the next scene they're just fine, and you're like, no, but okay, it's they need recovery time. You
Yeah.
know, that person got stabbed. You know, are they checking their injuries? How are they treating their injuries? Do they have bandages? When have they changed the bandages? You know, what if it becomes infected? These are all things to consider.
I think the other thing people don't, writers don't necessarily always consider, particularly if they start out writing a fight scene, is the psychological effect of getting hit. If you've never ever been hit, it's a real shock the first time it happens, and even the second and third time. Okay, we've done martial arts for years and years, and presumably you've been smacked in the face a fair bit as well. But you can get used to it so that your regroup time, if you like, is quicker. So I'm not suggesting I want to be, but I can get smacked in the face now, and as long as it doesn't knock me out completely, my regroup time is quite quick. But that's not something that happened overnight. That happened through, it teaches you to block much more effectively as well next time round. I will say blocking in the
Apparently
face
not
is not the
Buffy.
best way to go.
Yeah, there is a massive psychological effect, and people don't come back from being punched in the face very easily. You've punched someone in the face, and they're drunk, and their nose is bleeding, and they're in pain, and they're blinking rapidly because the sensory, well, there's a lot of things going on. You know, they're bleeding. You tend to
Well, their
blink
eyes would be
rapidly.
watering as well.
Their eyes are going to be watering. They're going to be confused because they've gone from standing to sitting on their asses very, very quickly. They're not going to get up fast. They're not going to get up fast, because you also have to consider that it takes a moment to, especially if you've been drinking, to catch up with what's happening, because that's a big change. Pain does take a while to register, not in that obviously you feel pain instantaneously, in the understanding of what's happening, because when you're in pain, that is your brain saying something is wrong. So all of it tends to be that all of your concentration suddenly goes into what is wrong, what do I need to fix?
Ideally, the thing to do is not to get involved, but it's if you have no other option.
If you are, if yes, the best thing to do is not, is as Jill says, not to get involved. And that is something for your characters to consider as well, unless they're a hothead. Most martial artists with training will actually rather not get involved. And most martial artists with training finish all of their fights with a very particular move called running away, which is and that it tends to be that if you are writing a character, or if there is a character who is has had that training, they probably have a very similar attitude. And it doesn't matter how much training and how good you are, you get away from the threat. That is the best form of defense.
So have a reason for your characters not to be running away if they're not going to run away. Okay, that brings me on to my last couple of little bugbears, which are sort of associated. And one is people suddenly, with no training whatsoever, fighting way beyond their ability with no reason at all. And the other one is people with actual training suddenly becoming crap
This is
and
something
bitten.
that you get in a lot of superhero arcs. Well, what happens is
Yep.
the chosen one arrives, and the okay, th this is the typical. This tends to be the formula, which is chosen one arrives, and a woman has to teach him how to fight, and she's really badass, and she's really good at stuff, and he's useless, and she's there like, oh, why aren't I the chosen one? And she teaches him, and in the space of like a couple of weeks, he becomes as good as her. And he ends up taking the boss, and she sort of ends up having trouble with the boss's subordinate, which doesn't really make sense. And I think it also gives people a false expectation of how long it's going to take them to learn stuff. The amount of people who join martial arts clubs because they think they're going to be brilliant after the first couple of weeks and then quit when they realize that no, it
Actually,
takes
it's all just
years.
hard work, like anything.
It is astounding. Now, obviously, there are other elements to it, which is that someone will obviously get better at fighting if there are higher risks, because they're going to be more invested, so they're going to work harder. But as you say, it is about hard work. But yes, the most annoying thing in literature is, and in just in general in the media, is when you have a character who's highly trained, who suddenly, in order not to oust the person who wasn't quite as trained, becomes worse as the story progresses, and the person who wasn't very good becomes better because they're the hero of the story. And it doesn't really work like that in reality. Yes, it doesn't matter what training you have, people do make stupid mistakes.
Anyone can get hit by a lucky punch, doesn't matter how good you are.
But the fact does remain that yes, that it does seem to be an issue that in order to make your main character good at fighting realistically when they weren't, you have to make the others not quite as good.
I think the ones that work best for me are where you have a main character who perhaps never becomes quite as good at fighting or in battle as the person they're opposing, but this main character is very good at outthinking that person.
And yeah, that does tend to be something which works, but that needs to be highlighted at the beginning that their skill is about outthinking. Yeah, I'm sorry to talk about Hamartia Cycle again, but I've got Faye, who's my warrior, and she is the best fighter out of the lot of them, and she can be beaten in battle, and she has been, but she's definitely a better warrior, at least than Rufus, and she decides to train Rufus how to fight. And he turns around and says, "Well, I know how to fight." And she just looks at him and she says, "Setting things on fire and running away is not a durable form of defense. You can't just keep doing that." And it's a running joke that Rufus's way of fighting is just to set something on fire and flee, which works for the majority of the time. But they're about to go to war, and unfortunately, he's very much guerrilla warfare, jump out at people when they're not expecting it. He's very good at that kind of thing, because he's had to be. But he's not very good in a one-on-one fight because he doesn't have any training. He doesn't know how to stand his ground. He doesn't know how to fight somebody with a sword, and he doesn't know what to do if he's surrounded. People tend to specialize in one thing, and if you've had, which is why that's a slight bugbear with Aragorn, was that Aragorn was sort of he was a ranger. And then suddenly he became an army general.
In fairness, he had had 80 years to acquire all that knowledge, so I'm
This
sort of willing to let that go.
is true. This is true. But there are different kinds of fights. There's, you can have years and years of experience when it comes to a bar fight. And actually, if you are very, very highly trained in sort of martial arts, you can really be thrown out by somebody who's good in a scuffle fight, because the rules are completely different, the moves are different, everything works in a very different way, and the intimacy of the fight feels very different. And so that's another thing to consider. Apparently, we're addressing writers today. Another thing to
Writers, get your
consider.
stuff together.
Another thing to consider is that people will fight in different ways, and there are people who specialize in long distance and short distance and ambush guerrilla warfare. Just because you're good at sort of fencing doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be good at throwing knives. So things to consider.
Think we should probably round it up there, although I
I
could
agree.
quite happily talk about fighting for a bit longer.
I think we will return to this topic. Reviewing what we've looked at, we had a look at Buffy the Vampire Slayer, going on to Daredevil and Jessica Jones.
Book-wise, we had a look at Tamora Pierce and Joe Abercrombie, Mark Lawrence, who I think all in their own ways write very, very good fight scenes.
We also then had a look at The Lord of the Rings and the comparison between the fights in the books and in the movies.
So the good point there to make is that a lot of it can happen off screen in a book as long as you know exactly what to show. Less is more, but again, have some knowledge of physics and anatomy.
And finally, we just had a look at general sort of pro sort of tips when it comes to actually fighting, and some of the ways in which people can generically go wrong. Well,
And
we
how
hope
about
you've enjoyed it.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please do subscribe to us on iTunes or on Podbean.
Until next episode, then. See you guys.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast via Podbean or through iTunes. For more information, please visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.